but I'm glad that everybody could come along today for this launch of the second stage of the Centre for Advanced Journalism's report on the media and the Black Saturday fires. Indeed, what we are launching today is not only the second stage report, but this very handsome book, which incorporates both stage one and stage two of what is, in my humble view, landmark research both into the way the media reported the Black Saturday fires and the impact of that reporting on the survivors, those who were subjected to the media spotlight, often in the most trying and tragic circumstances. Today's launch is about this stage, that stage of the project. We journalists hardly ever get the chance to both reflect on the work we do and to consider what impact our reporting has on the people we report on. I think it is important that we do both. That's why we embarked on this project in the first place. The Centre for Advanced Journalism's mission is to improve the practice of journalism, and I believe this research, this publication, honours that commitment. I want to acknowledge the organisations that have supported this research. Emergency Media and Public Affairs, EMPA, Research and Development Committee, the Victorian Department of Human Services, Emergency Management Branch, the Department of Planning and Community Development, the Victorian Bushfires Reconstruction and Recovery Authority, and the DART Centre for Journalism and Trauma Australasia. In addition, the Victorian Bushfire Reconstruction and Recovery Authority, VIBRA, assisted in the identification and initial contact with respondents.
I'm sorry about that.
I'd also like to acknowledge the support we got from media monitors, generously provided staff time and other resources to assist in the analysis of the data on media coverage during the period from which the sampling of survivors was undertaken. I also want to thank the media people who agreed to be interviewed for this research, and most particularly, I want to thank the survivors who so readily agreed to be part of this project. And I do want to thank CAJ staff members, Lucy Chancellor-Wheel, Louise Graham and Emily Bitto, for their dedication to and enthusiasm for this project. Without their hard work, really, we would not be here today. I now want to hand over to Dr. Dennis Muller. I find it very hard to call journalists doctor, but it is Dr. Dennis Muller, the chief researcher on both parts of this research. Dennis is an old colleague of mine at The Age, and really it's been a privilege to work with him on this project. Dennis is an outstanding journalist, thinker, researcher, and an outstanding wearer of many different hats. I mean that both figuratively and literally, even though he hasn't got a hat on right now. There's a song about keep your hat on, isn't there? I think there is, yeah. Dennis, keep your hat on. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome Dennis Muller.
Thank you, Michael, and I would like to add my welcome to all of you for being here. And I would also, we'll come to a couple of other acknowledgements as we go along. Okay. In 2009, the Centre for Advanced Journalism here at the University of Melbourne interviewed 28 media practitioners about the ethical issues they confronted in covering the Black Saturday bushfires. And we also asked them about the emotional impact on them of covering the fires. The results of that research were presented to the media industry and the journalism profession at a conference at the University of Melbourne in November 2009, and was subsequently published in a book by Melbourne University Press entitled Media Ethics and Disasters: Lessons from the Black Saturday Bushfires. It's available through the Melbourne University Press website. It's also in here. In the course of that research, it became obvious to us that we were looking at only half the story. The other half, the impact of media activity on bushfire survivors, was at least equally important. The Centre for Advanced Journalism took up this challenge with generous financial support from the people that Michael has just mentioned. But I would also like to say that in addition to their financial support, Kate McMahon, the Managing Director of the DART Centre Asia Pacific, and Greg Ireton from VIBRA, the Victorian Bushfire Reconstruction and Recovery Authority, contributed significantly to the work, Kate by adding her expertise as a psychologist with great experience in assisting journalists, and Greg by providing the means by which we were able to approach bushfire survivors. We didn't want to go to the survivors directly. We thought that would be too difficult. It would be too difficult for them, we thought, to say no to people like us. So we decided we would approach them indirectly through VIBRA using the community committees where the approach would come from people whom the survivors knew and would be able to be frank with. And above all, of course, we would like to thank the survivors themselves who participated in this research. Some are present today. They gave generously of their time and of themselves. They were insightful in what they told us, and the entire value of the research derives from their contribution. We're very grateful to you. The objective of the first phase of the research was to discover what ethical dilemmas confronted the media people who covered the fires and how they resolved them. The objective of the second phase was to discover from survivors the effects on them of being the subject of media coverage. And the purpose of doing all this was to educate media practitioners in how to treat survivors, how to minimise harm, and how to reflect on the consequences of what they do. And secondly, to contribute to thinking on how best to manage disaster scenes. So there's stuff in here which is of relevance not just to the media, but to the authorities as well. We used a qualitative approach which consisted of in-depth, one-on-one personal interviews with each of the survivors who participated. This is the same method as was used in part one among media practitioners. We concentrated on what we will call, in inverted commas, ordinary people. That is to say, we excluded official people. We excluded policemen and firemen and CFA personnel and so on. We wanted to concentrate on people who were likely to have had little, if any, prior experience in dealing with the media and who were direct survivors, people who had a direct loss, if you like. In selecting the respondents, we took into account a number of factors. First, we wanted a mixture of survivors who'd been covered by those media practitioners whom we'd interviewed in part one, and survivors who'd been covered by other media practitioners. We wanted to see, apart from anything else, if there were any differences in their experiences. There weren't, as it happens. Second, we wanted survivors who had had a range of media exposures. Some people had had only one exposure to the media, some had had multiple exposures. Some had appeared in newspapers, on television, on radio, and multiple times. Third, we wanted to test a hypothesis from part one that a significant change occurs in survivors' attitudes to the media after about the first 48 hours. That's not a rigid number, but an approximation. So we needed survivors whose first media encounter had been within 48 hours of the fires, and those whose first encounter had been later than that. Fourth, we wanted a good balance of men and women, and we wanted to draw them from as broad a range of communities as possible. Data from media monitors, whom I too would like to acknowledge with grateful thanks for providing us with the data without charge, showed that in the research time frame of 8 to 15 February, so from the Sunday after the fires through to the following Sunday, There were 940 named individuals in the news coverage from which we drew our sample. And all of this data was analysed, collated, pulled together and organised for me by a lady called Vicky Lynch, who's also here today, who at the time was working in the coroner's office, but whose masters I had supervised, and her work in this sample preparation was extraordinary. Saved months of time. To ensure that we met these fairly exacting sampling criteria, we adopted a deliberative rather than a random approach. Each potential respondent was identified by us, then approached through Vibra. The final composition of the sample is up there. You'll see there were 27 people, and you'll see that we did manage to achieve what we set out to do in assembling it. I've organised the findings into seven broad themes. You'll see they are there. I'm going to talk away from this microphone for a bit. This concept of informed consent is extremely problematic, and we devote quite a lot of time to that. This 48-hour factor I've just mentioned to you. Then there are these two, what I think of as the two dimensions of media performance. Performance in gathering material and performance in publishing or broadcasting. We wanted to test media performance on both those dimensions. Then there's this whole question of how you balance the interests of the survivors against the interests of the media, because there are plenty of ways in which they conflict. There's this, what's turned out to be, very important concept of survivor autonomy, which I'll spend some time on. And then this question of long-term follow-up, whether journalists stayed on the story or were expected to retain a relationship with the survivors. We found that the concept of informed consent, in the sense that people give careful consideration to an approach from the media, is an impossible standard to apply in the immediate aftermath of a disaster. Survivors are in such a state of shock and disorientation that they cannot possibly give consent that is considered, as these two statements from survivors show. And you'll see there that you have a person saying, yeah, we were talking to a reporter, but I didn't make the connection that I was going to appear in the paper. And at another point, this respondent said, I told the reporter that one of the things I'd lost was my wedding veil. And he put that in the paper. Now, I haven't realised I told him that. They're good illustrations, I think, of the state of mind of survivors in the aftermath of a disaster. And so it is futile to think that consent can be informed in that sort of considered sense. Instead, what people relied upon was their instincts. And what fed into that instinctual response came down to this. Is this media person who's asking me for an interview respecting my autonomy? And they made their judgment about that on the basis of these factors here on the slide. They did not like pushy approaches. Journalists who were pushy, they said no to. They wanted people to introduce themselves honestly. They didn't want people to sidle up to them, engage them in conversation, and then, at some later point, reveal to them that they were from the media. They wanted people to be upfront with them. They wanted media people to ask open questions. Would you like to tell me what happened? Rather than, it must have been terrible. Or, worst of all, how do you feel? Open questions. Because what open questions do is they allow the survivor to decide the parameters of the answer, to put the boundaries around what it is they're prepared to talk about. It confers power on the respondent. And if the survivor became upset, the reporters who were considered to be respecting people's autonomy were the sort of reporters who would say, "Would you like to stop? Would you like me to go away?" Where the media were found wanting on these matters, survivors had no hesitation in refusing, and there is a wonderful quote here which illustrates the point. This survivor had already given an interview to one media person who, he said, had come down the driveway somewhat tentatively, had come up and introduced himself properly, had said, "Look, I'll go away now if you want me to, but if you'd like to tell me what happened, I would be very glad to hear your story." And this respondent said to me, "I don't mind talking to people like that. That was fine, I spoke to him." But he said about an hour later, another lot came. And they were coming down the road saying, "We're here to interview you, fella." And he said, "There's no bloody way." So you can see how survivors are, particularly in this immediate aftermath, this first 48 hours or so, they're quite robust about making this kind of decision. And we have come to the conclusion that, based on what survivors have told us, this instinctual consent process is sufficient in the circumstances. Survivors can even make allowance for the television glamour factor. But you'll see behind that very amusing quote, there's a serious point. A person who dresses like that, and it needn't be a woman, of course, a person who appears in the fireground dressed to the nines lacks empathy, is telling the survivor, "I lack empathy, I'm different from you, and perhaps I'm better than you." So that kind of thing, there are serious lessons lurking in those statements. Only one survivor said that they'd felt pressured and was regretful about the exposure, and this pressure had come not directly from the media, but from a government entity's public relations arm. Generally, survivors told us that on balance, exposure through the media had done them more good than harm. That's an important statement, because when you think about the process of consent, in the end, their assessment of whether their decision on consent had been right or wrong, they fundamentally decided it had been right, because in the end, it had added up to more good than harm for them. They had many reasons, especially in the immediate aftermath, in that first 48 hours, for wanting to speak to the media. And there are some of them there. They wanted to tell the world what had happened. Very importantly, lots of people in the fireground wanted their families and friends to know they survived. They wanted to get help. Some people in some, especially small communities, had felt very abandoned. They had wanted some of them to vent their anger over this. They wanted their own story told in some cases. And another important factor was they wanted some say over what was published about them. Survivors said to me, "Look, reporters are going to write a story anyway, and if they're going to write about me, I'd rather they got the stuff from me than from somebody else, or, you know, mashed it together from hearsay." So they were the sort of main reasons why survivors wanted to speak. But then survivors' attitudes to the media did indeed undergo a change, as the media practitioners themselves had told us in part one. And there seem to be several reasons for this. Immediately after the disaster, survivors are in the grip of an extreme adrenaline high. This comes out in a variety of ways, as you can see from those quotes there, including euphoria, hyperactivity, and talkativeness. In addition to what's on the board there, I remember one survivor telling me that he was, quote, in mode, was his phrase for it. He was a sort of de facto community leader whose premises had become the kind of hub of activity for that little community in the immediate aftermath. And he was just running around doing stuff for people. He said, you know, he just couldn't stop. He wouldn't stop. And it's a good example, I think, of the way in which this hyperactivity had taken hold in that case. But then after about 48 hours, this effect begins to fade. And while adrenaline levels often remain abnormally high for weeks and even months, they are no longer sufficient to stem the rising tide of grief that accompanies the realisation of what has happened. And with this comes a change in their attitude to the media. As I indicated a minute ago, the media themselves had picked up on this, but they didn't fully understand the reasons. And so we spent quite a bit of time talking with survivors about this. And what many of them said was what's there on the slide, that it starts to sink in. And this respondent said, and then when it did, I couldn't talk at all. I just lost my voice. And then this other respondent here saying that it takes this amount of time to sink in, that she no longer had clothing or a house, the home. And so you can, again, they exemplify those two statements, I think, this process by which the reality becomes realised. And the change to the attitude to the media has many causes, and they're not only the sort of causes that the media had thought. It's certainly true, as the reporters thought, that survivors were no longer so ready to speak. They recognised that. But they didn't understand why. And many of our survivors have told us these things. Firstly, their initial need of the media has passed. They no longer need to get the word out about what's happened. They no longer need to get the word out to their families that they've survived. They no longer need to call for help. So lots and lots of those reasons that they had for speaking in the first place have gone. Secondly, and very interestingly, they don't think that the follow-up stories are real news in the sense that the initial story is real news. A lot of survivors said these stories about pathos, these stories that are designed to get people's emotions going. This isn't real news. This is exploitative and kind of confected news. So they didn't attach the same degree of legitimacy, if you like, to the news gathering function later as they had at first. Similarly, they began to see the media as exploitative rather than helpful. And they seem to also move from a stage of being prepared to speak about what happened and not wanting to speak about what happened, but more wanting to focus on the now and what next. One survivor illustrated this, I thought, very interestingly. He said, you know what it's like when a kid falls over and skins his knee? He wants to come running and he wants to tell somebody that he's skinned his knee. But then the next thing is he wants to know, well, who's going to fix it? You know, what treatment am I going to get? What's the do I have to go to hospital? What's the outlook? And he used that as an analogy, as a likeness for the process that he had gone through after the fires. So as we can see, this has many consequences for the media. It can no longer be taken for granted that survivors will accord the same level of legitimacy to media activities as they did at first. The chance of a refusal, perhaps even an angry refusal, increases, and the type of questioning that is acceptable changes. Now, Many of the survivors who spoke to us had had multiple encounters with the media, and most were considered by the survivors to have been respectful and beneficial. Some involved acts of real generosity. A few encounters were diabolical. As an example of one of the acts of generosity, there was the reporter who gave his safety mask to a survivor who was scrabbling in the dust of her home looking for her wedding ring. And the reporter had said to her, do you know whether there was any asbestos in this house? And the lady said she didn't know. And the reporter said, well, there may have been, and if there was, then you know, it's a dangerous business. And anyway, he couldn't dissuade her from continuing to look, so he took off his own safety mask and gave it to her. And then, by contrast, there was the photographer who pressured a teenage boy to hide a camera in his sock and take forbidden photographs for him on the resident's first return to Marysville, until the boy's father intervened and told him to shove off. Other aspects of behaviour by some media people, by no means all, also attracted criticism. And you can see them there. There is one particularly ugly and reprehensible line of questioning that people found deeply offensive was this attempt to provoke extreme statements about what should happen in the event that it was discovered that any of the fires had been started deliberately. And people, not only were people offended by the nature of the questions, they were offended by what they thought it said about the reporter's attitude to them, the survivors. They thought that the reporters were of the view that here were a bunch of hicks and rednecks who could be relied upon to say something like this. So they took it as a seriously insulting line of questioning, apart from being offensive in a more general sense. The dreaded how do you feel question. And then an inclination later on, as communities start to rebuild, an inclination to continue to want to focus on the negatives when there were many other things to report. That was a characteristic that some people reported later on in the process, well after the initial period. And above all things, trying to get people to cry for the camera. Most survivors didn't mind so much if the crime came upon them spontaneously. Some even didn't mind being seen weeping on television or in newspaper photographs, because they said there was an authenticity to it. That's how it was. That's how I felt. But this was contingent on their having consented to its being used and on the fact that it had arisen spontaneously. Efforts to make them cry really made them angry and upset. This practice is unethical and inexcusable. It does real harm by adding to the distress of people who are already distressed. One respondent, confronted by this, showed extraordinary presence of mind. And he was saying in the interview to me, he said he tried to get me to cry, you know, Dennis. This was a television reporter. I said, did he, mate? I said, how did he do that? He said to me, you're a big, tough bloke, he said, but I bet you've got a soft centre. Am I right? And the respondent said, I'm going to lean into your personal space, he said, to answer. And he leans right into my face. And he said, and I said to this reporter, Gary, I find you a very attractive man. Which rendered the footage rather useless. The propensity for some in the media to seek out and focus on negativity in a way that was disproportionate to what survivors saw as the reality was an aspect of the coverage that caused frustration among survivors as they moved into the rebuilding phase. And in this, they discerned an inclination by some in the media, again, by no means all, but by some in the media, to try to create stories that conform to some preconceived idea of what the story should be, rather than what the fact suggested it really was. This tendency to what they saw as agenda-driven journalism, that is to say, journalists trying to construct a story that conformed to his or her own agenda, was the source of some frustration. But in a more important sense, it also detracted from the survivors' sense of it being their story and not the media's story. This idea of story ownership is part of a concept we have called survivor autonomy, a concept that has emerged as being of central importance to the ethical treatment of survivors. Consider this, and I would say this to a room full of journalists. Consider this, you've just survived a disaster. Perhaps you've lost people you love. You have only the clothes you stand up in. An overwhelming force has stripped you of your home, your possessions, perhaps your livelihood. It has taken away many of those things that added up to your position in the world. With them have gone much of your independence and self-sufficiency. You are suddenly dependent on others for the necessities of life. What you have left is your personal autonomy, your status as an individual human being, and the core dignity that that entails. This dignity includes the right to decide whether or not to speak, whom to speak with, and what to speak about. The survivors who participated in this research exercised this right and, as we have seen, exercised it in ways that, on the whole, did them more good than harm. They were able to assess those in the media who recognised the importance of survivor autonomy and who showed by their conduct that they respected it. To those media people, survivors tended to say yes. To others, they tended to say no. In the context of a disaster, these are high-stakes decisions. A survivor who decides to speak to the media is taking that media person on trust. If that trust is betrayed, the risk of harm is real. Where it is honoured, positive good may come. Consequently, for media practitioners, this is a matter of substantial ethical significance. Recognition of and respect for survivor autonomy is a core ethical duty. It acknowledges the survivor's essential human dignity. Happily, it is also the best way to get the story. Respecting and recognising survivor autonomy is achieved by the media's placing in the survivor's hands as much control over the encounter as possible, approaching gently, asking open questions, remembering it is the survivor's story, not the reporter's story, remembering the media's function is that of a vector through which the survivor's story is conveyed to the world. This is how many survivors were treated, and it reflects well on the ethical standards of many in the media people who covered the fires. However, it is clear from part one of the research that the concept of survivor autonomy, its underlying factors, and its ethical importance are matters on which media practitioners, especially those in executive positions, need educating. As I indicated at the start, there are two dimensions to media performance in gathering material, which we've just discussed, and performance in publishing or broadcasting it, and it's to this that we now turn. Broadly speaking, survivors said that most of what was published or broadcast about them was accurate in its essentials, in its kernel, as one of them said, even if minor errors upset them at the time, and generally portrayed them fairly. One aspect of this, though, needs mentioning. Some of the more arresting footage has been used repeatedly, and while the survivors in those pictures cannot be recognised by others, they can be recognised by the survivors themselves, and every replaying of it renews the grief for them and their families. This is a matter on which the needy need to be more sensitive and more aware. A further area of inquiry concerned the complex question of balancing media and survivor interests. There were three main interests and issues here. These questions of protecting survivors from the media, access to the disaster scene, and intrusion on private property. On the first question of protecting survivors from the media, the survivors who were approached in the fire ground in the immediate aftermath were, for the most part, only too pleased to see the media. For many, it was the first chance they had to let the world know what had happened, to let their families and friends know they'd survived, and put out calls for help. They said they gained definite benefits from this. It relieved them of having to tell their story over and over again in subsequent weeks. It meant they could allay the fears of family and friends. It resulted in an outpouring of generous assistance from family, friends, acquaintances, and the wider Australian community. It brought pressure to bear on the authorities to get help to where it was needed. However, a different assessment was made when survivors discussed the issue of protection beyond the first 48 hours and outside the fire ground, at relief centres, for example. At these places, where there were large concentrations of media and many vulnerable people, survivors said there was a need for protection. They found it valuable to be told that they didn't have to speak to the media, it was okay to say no. On the other hand, they were told that if they wanted something done, talking to the media was a good way of getting it done. They found the police media people savvy and reassuring. They found the advice about how to exploit the media helpful and empowering. And they liked the option of having a door they could go through to talk to the media and another door they could walk through to avoid the media. They agreed with the practice of having the media excluded from survivors' meetings and of having defined areas where the media could and could not go in and around the meeting halls and relief centres. They said that, on the whole, the media respected the controls that were placed on them, although we know from part one of the work that there were a few atrocities, especially at relief centres. Access to the scene. The central question here was whether the media should get access to the scene before the survivors. This was a matter on which the survivors had mixed views, although it came down to this. The media really do need to get into the scene so they can tell the survivors, as well as the rest of the world, what is going on. In the very early stages, survivors recognised that it was not only impossible to keep the media out, but that there were benefits from their being able to tell the world what had happened. However, when it came to organising convoys, the strong view was that the residents should be taken in first. This is obviously a difficult matter for the emergency services to manage, but there was a lot of hurt caused by people seeing through the media what they strongly stated they should have seen for themselves. Access to private property. We discovered in part one an extraordinarily wide range of practices by the media when deciding how to treat private property. Some simply did not go on. Others followed the standard rule of trespass: stay until you're told to go. I said to them, well, what if the owner's not there? Oh, well, the owner's not there. And some thought that private property had, for practical purposes, ceased to exist. Most survivors were appalled at the idea that media would go on private property without permission, although some were tolerant of it. Nearly all survivors said there should be one rule: do not go on private property without the prior consent of the owner. Full stop. Survivors generally did not expect the media people to stay in touch. Sometimes they did. Real friendships grew up. This I didn't hear a lot of this, But there were a couple of cases which were really very striking. I want to share one with you. It involved a television current affairs reporter who became and remains, it seems, a friend of the entire family. And this reporter had become a kind of resource for the family. The survivor told me that when it all got too much for him, he was able to ring this reporter, and she would make phone calls on his behalf to insurance companies, councils, government departments, and take the weight off him. And he couldn't say enough about the goodness of this person. He said, encountering this reporter was the first positive thing that happened to him after the fires. That is, I think, an unusual case, but it shows what can happen when reporters do follow up. Lots of the reporters we spoke to in part one, remembering this was 6 months after the fires, compared with 2 years when we spoke with survivors. Within that first 6 months, quite a lot of the reporters that we spoke to said they had been back in touch with the people they'd interviewed, not necessarily to get a story, just to see how they were. And they reported that at that stage the survivors had been very grateful to hear from them. And the reporters themselves had felt good about doing it. But of course there is there's a kind of, I suppose, natural cycle with these things, I don't know. Certainly survivors don't expect journalists to follow up. It's just that when they do, lots of good things can often happen, but it's not expected. Finally, our conclusions. Firstly, informed consent in the sense that it's considered is impossible. Instinctual consent is sufficient. Survivors are in shock and adrenaline charged. This places a large responsibility on media practitioners to treat them with care and respect. In the first 48 hours or so, and especially within the disaster scene, survivors obtain benefits from having access to the media. After about 48 hours, there is a significant mood change that alters survivors' responses to media approaches. This has significant consequences for the way the media should approach and deal with survivors. The concentration of media at relief centres creates extra pressure on survivors. Protective strategies become necessary. These strategies should give survivors options to speak with the media or avoid them. Trying to get survivors to cry for the camera causes unjustifiable harm. It is a core ethical duty to recognise and respect the autonomy of survivors. Media practitioners need educating about this. Organised access to the scene should be given first to survivors and then to the media. And media practitioners should stay off private property unless they have prior consent of the owner. Thank you.
Well, thanks very much, Dennis. I just want to say that if any of you want a cup of coffee or a cup of tea, just get up and, this is informal, just go and get yourself one. We'll distribute these to you when we're finished, so you'll each get a copy of that. I think you'd agree with me that that Dennis, in his presentation, raised some very important and serious issues in both the way the media operates in disaster areas and the way survivors feel about that, about being part of media coverage. I think that the findings are clearly open to debate. The issue, some of the issues that Dennis raised, I don't think are settled and need much more debate and consideration, especially by media companies. I think in particular editors, news directors and others. For me personally, the major issue really is this question of consent. How do media people like me, how do journalists know whether a person is able to consent to an interview, understands what's going to be involved in being interviewed? You would have seen in one of those that one of the people said, I wasn't even aware it was going to appear in a newspaper. I could imagine that person's shock. Not necessarily bad shock, not necessarily upset, but the shock of suddenly being in the newspaper the next morning. I think there is an issue of are journalists well enough prepared in terms of understanding what happens to people in a disaster like this, what happens to them in the immediate aftermath, what happens to them 48 hours later, what happens to them 6 months later, so that they're prepared and understand what they're dealing with. And I hope we have that debate. I hope journalists have that debate. I think this report can certainly form the basis for that sort of debate. And this report shouldn't be the final word on this. I think there's, you know, Australia is a country, as we all know, that regularly has natural disasters, unfortunately. Floods, fires. And we in the media need to think about the way we cover those disasters, the ethical basis on which we cover them, and what we need to understand about people who are the victims of these disasters. Let me now please introduce Cheryl Carter. Cheryl lived in Kinglake and lost her house in the fires. She is one of the many people affected by the fires, some of whom are here today. She was a participant in the research, and I'd like to personally thank you, Cheryl, for agreeing to be part of the research. And Cheryl has agreed to share with us some of her experiences of that time and of being covered by the media. Cheryl, thank you.
Good morning. First of all, I'd like to say thank you to the Centre for Advanced Journalism for undertaking this invaluable research. I would also like to personally say thank you to Dennis for the respect that he accorded me during interviews and following conversations. I'll try to outline a bit of what happened that night so that you may more easily understand where I'm coming from. Intense shock hit the town of Kinglake that night as the town went from no sign of a fire to being fully alight within 10 minutes. Both my husband Bill and I suffered burns whilst trying to escape the flames, and one of our dearly loved dogs perished. And we also lost our house. But so many people lost so much that night. We lived on adrenaline for 18 months and remained in a state of shock for that period. We finally realised we were not coping and were able to find help. We feel that we've come a long way since then. Although we are both health professionals, post-traumatic stress has been a very steep learning curve for us. We had difficulty understanding it, so I can see how difficult it is for others in the public or journalists to understand it when they have not experienced it. On the night of February 7th, I was taken to hospital with burns to my feet, and I had not seen my husband Bill for 8 hours. The last time I'd seen him, his arms were badly burned and he was in significant shock. And we both were of the view that the other had perished. Whilst being taken into an emergency department cubicle, my name was called out, and it was my husband Bill sitting up on a hospital trolley. And of course, this was a truly great moment for us to know that each other was alive. We had a bit of trouble with hugging. I couldn't stand and his arms were in a bad way. This was seen as a happy story in the midst of all the sadness, and the media wanted us to tell our story. We consented to an interview as we were told by the hospital media people that this would lift the profile of the burns unit and hopefully bring more funding. We were very glad to do this for the hospital, as we'd been so well cared for. And so many staff that the public don't realise went the extra mile for us and other burns victims. Such things as coming in on their days off and doing extra shifts, and many, many other small but very significant things. And these fires impacted on these people very, very strongly. I look back now and I don't know how I put two words together during this interview, given the shock and the trauma that we were experiencing. At the time, we thought we were quite rational and quite clear thinking. I now understand that we were in a very surreal, euphoric mindset with an underlying hysteria. The interview consisted of approximately 12 journalists from TV, print and radio, and it was held in the hospital ward. There were some interviewers who respectfully stayed out of our personal space and were very gentle in asking their questions. Others pushed their microphones right into our personal space. One reporter who arrived late and was quite angry about missing most of the interview, in a demanding manner, insisted that they be allowed to repeat the interview so that they could ask questions and get film footage. I found this to be very disrespectful. It seemed that her peace was much more important to her than consideration of how we might have been holding up. And this interview was within the 48-hour period. It was just on 48 hours after we had both been very close to losing our lives, and it was difficult to deal with. The other thing that we didn't really realise, which Dennis has touched on, is what would happen after we did this interview. We really weren't in a space to give it any consideration. The next day, after the interview went to air, both the ward phone, my bedside phone, and my mobile phone just went berserk. They just didn't stop ringing. In the end, I vetted calls on my mobile. I didn't answer the bedside phone, and the poor ward clerk, she took so many messages for us, and she was so patient about it. I was surprised to learn that the next morning a photo of my husband and I was on every major newspaper in Australia. Over and over again on the news at night. And then I got a phone call from my niece in Scotland. She'd seen it on YouTube. And my brother got calls from his friends in America. So this was pretty profound and certainly unexpected. Also after the interview, we had people walking into the hospital, visiting us, wanting to bring us things, people that we had no idea who they were. And in one way, this was very humbling for us. In another way, there was just no time to collect your thoughts. And I would have to say that perhaps no one, even the media people, envisaged this outcome. After much thought, it seems to me that the media coverage of Black Saturday was a double-edged sword. There were many positives, and then there were some less than positive experiences. For me, the positives were around I was sitting in a hospital bed and I felt so estranged from Kinglake and the aftermath of Saturday. And part of me wanted to really be there. So the media coverage allowed me to find out more about what had happened and what continued to happen through the week via my television in the hospital. I also imagine that there would have been people who saw their loved ones on TV who had survived at a time when they probably couldn't contact them by phone. People have said to us that it was wonderful to see a happy story in amongst so much sadness, that we had found each other. I think it was especially good for the people who picked my husband up the night he was burnt. They didn't have room for me in their car, and they took him because he was so badly burnt and he just needed to get out of the flames. They suffered considerable guilt at not being able to take me. And if it were not for them, my husband would not have survived. They rang me the morning after the interview aired, and I think it was really beneficial for them to be able to make contact with me. Our next door neighbour, who had gone looking for us and was unable to find us, she, through the media, realised that we were alive. One of my dogs had survived and he'd wandered into a Kinglake house, one of the few that was still standing. And I believe that as a result of the TV interview, he was taken to the animal rescue clinic and was then able to be collected by our friends. And this was a very important outcome for Bill and I, as our dogs are very dear to us. Another positive, I think, is that we seem to end up being a conduit for so many members of the public who wanted to be able to express their empathy and concern for the bushfire victims, that they just didn't know how to go about it. So they knew where we were, they knew our names, and they used us, I guess, to express their sympathy. We got cards and letters from people that, you know, I have no idea who they are, and a lot of them wouldn't even put their surname. They didn't want us to get back to them, they just wanted to be able to say something. And look, I also believe the media coverage played an important role in people being able to see what had happened, and as a result, the generosity of people in the donations they gave, which of course, you know, has made a huge difference to many survivors, all that financial help. And lastly, on the positive front, we were approached by a journalist who wished to do a documentary to commemorate the first year anniversary. He came to our home, he listened patiently and respectfully to us and spent a number of hours with us. The next day, Bill rang him to tell him that we just didn't feel up to it, and after all the hours he spent with us. And he was very understanding, very considerate, and in no way did he make us feel uncomfortable for refusing. I think the documentary was an excellent and respectful piece of work, and many people have told me that. For me, the less positive experiences were in the couple of days after the interview, I had overwhelming and distressing guilt about the fact that I was sitting up in a hospital bed and I was able to smile and laugh about something good that had happened to me. I was in clean clothes, I had food and shelter, and I just felt that this must seem horrendous to me. This seemed horrendous to me at a time when people would be watching and they had lost families and friends and memories and homes. And I was mortified that I'd done the interview. During the interview, I felt that some, and I stress some, reporters focused on me with their questions in the hope that I may shed some tears and make a better, more dramatic story. As a result, my husband felt that he was portrayed as having left me and the dogs in the middle of the fire. He was incredibly distressed about this for a very long time. The interview presented my ordeal, but very little of his. In actual fact, the car he was in, that he drove off in, was surrounded by a fireball and by some miracle did not explode. After he got to safety and put some water on his burns, someone drove him back to look for me. But his story was never really told. It was important for us that the people of the burns unit be thanked, and we asked for this, but it did not occur, and this was very disappointing. During the year after the fires, we were contacted by a journalist who wished to come to our home and do a follow-up story and have some photos taken. This turned out to be an unfortunate experience. We rearranged appointments, etc., to be home at a time suitable to meet the journalist. Just the day before the interview, he rang to say something more important had come up and he would do a telephone interview with us, but could he send a photographer? The photographer was uninspired by our rented home, as we were, I might add. It really didn't lend itself to a good picture. We really felt like we were a bit of a nuisance to him, and I exacerbated that by insisting that our one dog that survived be in the photo, and he was totally non-compliant with cameras. The telephone interview never eventuated and the story was never used, and we were not concerned about that, but we did feel used. There was no respect for us rearranging our lives and also for the memories that this type of thing brings back. Journalists go back to their daily lives, but the survivors have to sit with it and process the feelings that have come up as a result. Bill and I informed the hospital not to give our mobile numbers out anymore. We didn't want any further media involvement. We had lost trust at this stage. Unfortunately, a reporter got a hold of our private landline number and rang wanting an interview. This, I thought, was very intrusive and disrespectful. At one stage there, and perhaps it was just my paranoia and my post-traumatic stress, but I started to feel after that phone call on the landline that I've seen photos on the news of, you know, taking footage of people's houses, outside their houses, where obviously they don't need informed consent, and they'll make a story out of something. As I said, this might have been my paranoia, but I started to get really concerned that this would happen. And I didn't want our house having photos taken of it. We were fortunate enough to be able to move away and start a new life, but there were still people in King Lake in caravans and tents going through a winter with snow. And so that really distressed me. That one phone call on the landline really distressed me. I'll be very interested to read the report on the journalist interviews. I imagine they suffered their own form of stress and trauma, and I imagine there are very many members of the public, such as the police and all those people that cared for the survivors, that have suffered their own form of stress and trauma. And there's many of them that have, you know, the survivors got recognition and many of these people didn't. Even down to the shopkeeper in the corner store who you happen to go in and buy some milk and it's not a good day, and he's at the end of your anger. All those people have been affected. There's probably not much more that I can add. I believe that authenticity and integrity in reporting stories is extremely important, coupled with a respectful and empathetic manner. It is an important task that the media undertakes, and when done with integrity and accuracy, it benefits us all. Thanks for listening.
Thank you very much, Cheryl. I mean, that was great. There's a couple of things that you raised that I just want to point to that I think are really, really important. One, the sense that the media covers these disasters in a kind of formula. There's the tragedies, and then there's the heroes, and a happy story and a sad story. I mean, to categorise your story as a happy story is to mischaracterise what happened to you. And I imagine that's the response you had a couple of days later of seeing yourself there smiling. And I mean, you were relieved rather than happy, and yet it was portrayed as a sort of happy story. The second thing is, I think that that struck me, and that I think is really important, that in all situations, but particularly in a disaster situation, there's a sort of contract between the journalist and the survivor, and the contract does involve the autonomy of the survivor and a recognition of the survivor's autonomy, but it also involves a recognition of what the survivor wants from the story, why they're doing it. And journalists have to recognise that. There is a kind of tacit agreement. I'm doing this because this is what I want from this story. And if you don't deliver that, I'll feel betrayed. And that's why I think you mentioned the fact that you had agreed to do this, basically because the Burns unit said they would get some credit out of this for their work, and perhaps some support for their work. That was a fundamental reason, I think, why you agreed to do the story. And yet in the reporting of the interview, there was no mention of the Burns unit or the work that the Burns unit was doing. And you felt betrayed by that. You felt like that was a betrayal. So I think the journalists need to understand there is an agreement, a tacit one, when somebody, a survivor, in the midst of their terrible tragedy that they've just gone through, agrees to be interviewed, we need to understand why they've agreed, and we have to deliver on that. Now, with that, I'm going to open the floor to a few minutes of questions. We don't want to go on for too long, but both Dennis and I are happy to answer some questions. Oh, well, yes?
Want to ask a bit more about the second phase after the first 48 hours. In the first 48 hours, what the journalists want, what the interviewees want, and what the public readership wants is all the same. They want to know what happened and how people felt. And then after that, as you described it, people's interests begin to differ. The survivors want to know what's going to happen to them and how they're going to be helped, what's next. As I recall what the journalists want, they want to blame somebody. Their formula at that stage is who was to blame for these bushfires and too many people dying. Was it the SEC? Was it, you know? How can you say a bit more about how you think the journalists should handle things when interests begin to diverge?
It's a good question, Bruce. In fact, I think the blame thing didn't begin for quite some time after that. But the main interest that the media people had in that second phase, as it were, was to try to tell lots of human stories, lots of pathos. That seemed to be their focus. The blame stuff came a bit later. But the point that you raise is nonetheless valid. At that point, the journalist's interest in generating content which will be arresting and interesting because of its emotional nature is in conflict with the interests of the survivors. The survivors see that as exploitative. And it's difficult to reconcile that conflict, except, I think, in a very broad way, to say that it's part of the total coverage which in totality did confer over time some of the benefits of the outpouring of generosity and so on. But I think it's a really difficult question to know how to reconcile the two, except to say that in obtaining that material, The media need to be aware of the survivor's state of mind and how that state of mind has altered, and tailor their questions and tailor their approach to the survivors accordingly. I can't see another way of reconciling that conflict. But the blame thing did come later, quite a bit later.
Can I just say on that, I think that the, I think it's a mistake to characterise it simply as a blame thing. I think there was a lot of debate in media companies and newsrooms, I know, about how long do we go on with, you know, survivor stories. I do think that... that in some media, in some newsrooms, the decision to look at what went wrong, why these things happened earlier than with others. I mean, I think, for instance, that the Australian started raising questions about why things had gone the way they had on the following Saturday, and they were the first media organisation to raise issues of what had gone wrong, who was responsible, and then the other media followed. But I do think that I think it's an important question of when you start doing that and when you stop with stories that are basically no longer, in my view, in the interests of the survivors, and not no longer really all that important in terms of news coverage. I think that they are really important questions. One other point that I'd like to make is that for survivors, I imagine, one of the most important parts of this issue is staying on the story, not so much in terms of their personal stories, but for survivors, one of the most difficult and important times is in the rebuilding phase. What's happening? Who's doing what? How is that working? How are Vibra performing their task? How's local government performing their role? What's the state government doing? What's happening with planning? What's happening with insurance? Now, at that point, the media is not quite as interested in the story as it was in the immediate aftermath of the fires. Now, I think that we need to examine that as well. I mean, for people on the ground, in some ways, that's the most important time. That's when they've got the most challenges, not just in terms of recovery for themselves personally and what they're going through, but in what's going to happen. And often at that time, the media have dropped off the story. Had there not been a Royal Commission where these issues were all raised, I think the media coverage would have been minimal. So we'll take another question or two. John?
Michael, you mentioned, and either Michael or Dennis or both can respond to this. I mean, you mentioned that very formulaic way of covering disasters, of set piece stories, which in to my mind is actually quite disrespectful of the broader community, because it says you're so dumb, this is how we're going to tell you this story. How do you as journalism educators and editors break that cycle and introduce some of the new dimensions that you just referred to at the very end of your answer there? How do you go about that?
Well, that's a very difficult question to answer. I mean, in a way, I think that's there's two parts to that. One is the quality of editors and news directors in terms of we operate in formulas all the time in journalism and in stereotypes. You know, there's tragedy, there's recovery, there's stories of heroes, there's stories that have happy endings. We have to find ways. I mean, quality journalism is about understanding that there are formulas, understanding that there are stereotypes, and breaking those. And that's only going to happen, frankly, if you have outstanding journalists and you have editors and news directors that support them. One of the problems, of course, with the media is that newspapers are in trouble and therefore, you know, blah, blah, blah. But I do think that that formula needs to be broken. I do think it's disrespectful And the idea that all stories of something, all natural disasters, for instance, need to have happy stories and moving on stories and next phase stories is disrespectful and frankly doesn't match with reality and the way people actually lead their lives.
I'd just like to add one or two points to that. Not all the bits of the stereotype are bad, in my view. Obviously, the first phase, the story of what actually happened, is vitally important. But I think there are aspects of that sort of formulaic process which are really, really awful. And one example of it I would call the tribute phase. Particularly, these are the phases where you get kind of heavy black bordered presentations of, for example, deceased children, which I know a lot of survivors and reporters found distasteful. I think there are some parts of the formula that should just be ditched. But I think probably on a bigger level, the dilution of the formula lies in the way in which individual reporters tell the stories, the extent to which they are able to meet the total contract that I think Michael very insightfully referred to. So to make sure that their story just doesn't conform to the happy story phase or the hero phase, but actually goes some way to meeting the needs of the respondent and the interviewee in a deeper way. That would seem to me to be a more respectful approach, and as a byproduct, I think, would help to whittle down the sort of formulaic thinking. The difficulty, as you would know, is that journalists have to routinise their work to an extraordinary degree day by day just in order to get the thing done. And so it's going to take a big mind change, and that's part of our job as educators to try to bring this about.
Okay, we might... just one other small thing on that issue of that Dennis raised. I mean, I don't know how many of you read or saw what the New York Times did after 9/11 with the victims of 9/11. They actually published it all in a book in the end. They did a biography of every victim of 9/11. They did it over months and years in the paper. I think it took 2 or 3 years for them to cover everybody. And then they published it as a book. Now, those little biographies were brilliant. I mean, they were high quality, respectful, honouring the victims' journalism. Unfortunately, editors around the world saw this, and ever since then, newspapers and others around the world have been publishing these little photographs with little biographies. Most of them are terrible. Most of them aren't respectful of the victims. Most of them don't deserve to be published. So it all comes down to quality. It all comes down to how well you do these things. And that's what journalism education ought to be about. Look, I'm going to call a halt to proceedings now. Thank you all for coming. I hope you found it informative and interesting. Please collect a copy of the report of the book. And we hope to see you again sometime soon. Thank you.